want to break into the system.
Someone without access to the exam.
I have been doing a little hacking here, as a matter of fact.
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
Welcome to the June 13th edition of the In the Now Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with...
VR, feeling a little feisty.
A little feisty. And...
Rusty.
All right. Rusty's been on one of our previous shows. Pretty cool guy. Got a lot to say and got some interesting stories to talk about this evening. How's everyone doing?
Feeling feisty.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got that.
Pretty good.
How's that new book there that you were checking out?
It's excellent.
Okay. No, actually, I just got a new book. Can you hear me that, Rusty? I'm going to finally go through with it and get my amateur radio license. I've had a ham for a while, and thought it'd be good to actually go out and get it done and read up on some of the other things that go along with hamming. So, it's actually called Now You're Talking, All You Need for Your First Amateur Radio License, 5th Edition. There's a lot of pictures of people that look like they belong on radio in this book. So,
do they have radio faces?
They do, even the children.
Oh my God, is that a radio face?
Yeah, even the children have radio faces.
Well, that's because they have radio face parents. They got them into ham radio in the first place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, son,
you know
this.
What? I'm not wanting to offend any ham radio operators out there. They're probably very beautiful people.
Inside. I'm just joking. We're filled with jokes this evening. All right. Well, let's get straight to the news, and there is plenty of it. Well, as if this wasn't already known, there was a study done out there where basically 4/5 of all spam emanate from computers contaminated with Trojan horse infections, according to a study by network management firm Sandvine out this week. Trojans are worms with backdoor components such as MIGMAF, and so big have turned infected Windows PCs into drones in vast networks and compromised zombie computers. So about 80% of those computers out there are just spewing spam out. Sandvine reckons junk mails created and routed by spam Trojans are clogging ISP mail servers, forcing unplanned network upgrades and stoking antagonism between large and small ISPs. Using its own technology, Sandvine was able to identify subscribers bypassing their home mail systems, mail servers, and contacting many mail servers within a short period of time. A sure sign of spam Trojan activity over sustained periods, they also looked at SMTP error messages returned, which helped to clarify local volume or total volume of spam within the service provider network. I figured, you know, they say their own technology. Wouldn't that just be a sniffer with some rules in there to check for SMTP headers?
Isn't spam, like, outlawed by now?
I don't believe so.
Well, shouldn't it be? Because then that would give more incentive for, you know, people to sniff their own networks and to make sure that they're not a zombie. And it would actually make people be more, you know, take on the personal responsibility of, you know, cleaning up their site. And then you can take that one step further. What's the real cause for all this vulnerability? Microsoft.
Well,
because they're producing something which allows for a whole lot of vulnerability, and so you really get back to them, so you should just outlaw them.
Well, you know, the person doing the abuse is the spammer, not Microsoft. The person that's aiding in the abuse is Microsoft through lack of security. So yes. I wouldn't want to put the total blame on just
if you sell somebody, you know, like, if you sell somebody too many drinks and they go out and kill somebody, you help them. kill somebody, and you can be sued.
But you know what's ridiculous is there was a person, there was a gun manufacturer that was sued because a weapon had killed somebody, which was manufactured legally, it was sold legally, it was purchased legally, and they got sued to where it put them out of business. Is that correct?
Well, taking that same logic, we should be doing the same thing to Microsoft. Whether that is right or wrong, that is what occurred in our legal system. Therefore, that is a correct methodology for prosecution.
Isn't that a little bit blind, what you just said?
Isn't justice blind?
So why should we be just as blind as it?
Yeah, I'm looking for an argument to take down Microsoft here.
Oh, I know. I noticed what I'm saying. We can have plenty of those on the show. I just think I don't want to...
Well, yeah, of course it's not right.
I would like to focus on the spam problem.
Well, if you trace it back, they are the origin of it.
No, they're not the origin of it.
Well, they're not producing it, but they are enabling it for it to exist.
Okay. Well, you've made your comment.
Yeah, that was my whole comment.
And it's been heard.
It's good.
And I was going to say, after this was, they're actually thinking about doing a list for cell phone numbers and putting people's names, cell phone numbers, and doing that. And that would be incredible nuisance because now they can get you wherever you're at, wherever your cell phone is. And they're even talking about, this was on AM radio news, they're even saying that you could opt out of the list for a fee. So either way, they're going to sell the list for a fee to other people that want to market to you.
Or they're going to extort you.
Extort you, books with advertisements of, you know, or whatever, services you can use to find people's cell phone numbers, all that stuff. Very bad idea. I've never had any problems with my cell phone, and nor do I want to have any problems.
I could think of some advantages of, like, yeah, it'd be kind of strange that, like, the police get a hold of that and... Let's say instead of like flashing, you know, if you don't answer when they flash, you know, when they're pulling you over, they can call you up and go, pull over.
Oh, yeah, you bring up another story. You know, I actually am very upset that my name even shows up on the caller ID for my cell phone. That makes me mad.
Well, didn't you register it like that?
Well, I didn't. No, it actually, for years, it never did that until recently, in the last 2 years.
Ooh, well, that's kind of an interesting little change.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't like that. But, yeah, so 80% of zombie computers are the spammers out there, are just zombie computers shooting things out there and all that good stuff, which forces you to, of course, buy an antivirus product and an adware spam remover. You know, it's really generated a lot of money. You know,
yeah,
the spam doesn't work.
That, like, it's like McAfee and Norton that are actually producing all the spam, which no one really looks at, and it could be absolutely meaningless, so they sell more product.
Very well could be that they could be a contributor because they would benefit from that.
Yeah, and how else? Who better to exploit, you know, a security system than the security maker?
But there may be enough people out there banging on themselves to where they don't even have to think about it.
Yeah, but it makes me wonder: is there enough people that actually open up spam and buy the products? Is really spam?
Well,
profitable?
Well, we have found that there is a large amount of unintelligent people in this world. So do you think it's possible that they might want to use that strange ad for mail enhancement?
Yeah, there's a lot of mail enhancement spam.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of funny.
And it's even on AM radio all the time, too. So it works in that market as well.
Which is amazing, because if it really worked, don't you think that...
Everybody would be well endowed by now?
Well, and it would cost like $2 million. If it really, really worked, because, you know, guys that are really insecure about that would put themselves in a hawk for it if it really worked.
Yeah, but I think Ferrari would make more money if they actually lowered the amount of price for their cars and sold more. See, there's a balance. $2 million is quite a bit for that.
Yeah. Well, then just everybody should be well endowed, and then what does it really matter if everybody's the same size?
Wow. How did we get on this point? That is what I want to know. Okay. All right, moving right along. This is kind of interesting. I wish they would do this here, and maybe they will. It's becoming more popular to find free Wi-Fi spots to get access. Basically, statewide internet hotspots have been proposed by TxDOT, which is Texas. Austin, Texas is the first state in the nation to provide free wireless internet access at its safety areas and rest areas. Basically, they began experimenting with wireless internet service last fall when the department provided the capability at twin rest areas at US 287 and Donnelly County. Free wireless service also is available at two rest areas on the same highway in Hardman County. The feedback we received so far is very positive, said Dandy Keys, Safety Rest Area Project Manager for TxDOT's Maintenance Division. Texas highways are seeing an increased number of business travelers, truckers, and RVers, and access to email is important to them. They have really responded favorably to our four hotspots. They have taken the first step to expand the service to all of its 84 safety rest areas and 12 travel information centers by issuing a request for offer seeking vendors able to provide free wireless internet service and pay telephone-like internet access at kiosks.
Right on. I'm taking a road trip.
Yeah.
I'm going in there, and I'm using free internet access and hanging out at the truck stop.
Yeah, it's really great.
My two favorite things in the world.
Trucker chicks and Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
That's right. You meet a lot of interesting people at truck stops. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
I was actually at a truck stop where...
You should be your own kiosk, VR.
Yeah, plug a quarter in and I'll talk to you.
Yeah. that's really interesting. I don't know as, like, you can count on as far as, you know, confidentiality and what kinds of things, you know, who's monitoring those lines or anything like that. But, you know, if you're going to be surfing or saying hello to the family or whatever like that and you don't have any... worry of such issues, I think it's a great thing to have as much access as you can as in as many areas as possible. And on the Linux front, basically, the McDonald's in Germany is going to implement their IT infrastructure with SUSE Linux. And over in Germany, out of the 30,000 restaurants worldwide, there's about 1,200 McDonald's restaurants over there that they're going to be converting over to Linux to be running all their... computing and services and business and all that as well. So they basically saying here as well is that, you know, McDonald's makes use of state-of-the-art technology and mature concepts to support business workflows in the best way possible. So they have deemed that SUSE Linux is the way to go for them.
Now, that's one heck of an endorsement right there. When McDonald's says, your system is the best one, I think that's pretty intense.
Yeah. You know, think about it, though. It's only the Germany division.
Yeah, which are, you know, stereotypically known for their engineering meticulous nature.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that puts a little bit more emphasis on it. That's like some sugar sprinkling on the donut.
On the donut?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And actually, speaking of the Germans, I didn't even put this in this order. This was actually just an article that went back and it described, I didn't know this myself, that the Germans claimed that they made the first programmable computer. And here's like a little line that they have at the top. The Brits may have beaten the Americans, but it seems that they are both piped by the Germans. No, not football, computers. And that's the spin on the article. Colossus was not, in fact, the world's first programmable computer. The particular distinction belongs to the Z3 built in 1941 by Konrad Zuse, a German civil engineer. When Zuse met with Colossus team in 1980 and the two groups compared notes, they found they had all been working along very similar lines. The Z3 was based on a binary floating point number and switching system. It could perform between 3 and 4 additions per second and could multiply in around 5 seconds. The computer was fed in an old movie film punch with holes. An old movie film punched with holes, as paper was in short supply. It could perform basic arithmetic, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, and it could calculate square roots. His early experiments building a mechanical computer were based on telephone relays, the most widely available and reliable yes-no devices available to him at the time. Although he was aware of vacuum tubes, he opted to use relays in a Z3 because they were more reliable. The Z3's machine saw use during the war, but was not a code breaker. Instead, it was used to perform statistical analysis of the stresses of aircraft wings, and in particular, a problem known as a wing flutter. This vibration of the wings, aircraft's wing can cause a critical instability during flight. The calculations needed to overcome this design issue were incredibly complex, and it was this problem that the Z3 solved. Basically, Z3 was destroyed during bombing raids in the war, but Zeus managed to escape to Switzerland with its successor, the Z4, which now can be seen at the Dutch's Museum in Munich.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, actually, I didn't know anything of the history on the first programmable computer, but there's a little bit of it right there. And going back to wireless news, basically, and I know we talked about this, I think, in the last show, so I don't know if I'm reading another article that's just coming out with the same thing, or it's a new access point that has the same problem. Basically, the security bug in the Linksys Wireless G router, and we talked about this before, that they had a backdoor into it, which just basically allowed complete access to it. Security bypass flaw in a popular wireless broadband router shipped in by Cisco, Linksys unit could give malicious hackers administrative access to vulnerable devices, researchers warned on Wednesday, which is back early June. You know, when they say malicious hackers, they should just say given people with malicious intent administrative access to vulnerable devices, researchers.
How about opportunistic?
Opportunistic. Independent technology consultant Alan W. Redliff discovered the flaw during a client installation of a Linksys WRT54G wireless G broadband router. After reporting a vulnerability to Linksys, Redliff posted a warning on a public mailing list that even if the remote administration function is turned off, the router provides... Oh, it's the Netgear one? Well, go ahead. Jump on there.
Yeah. Use the mic. Okay, here's the power.
I have the story for the Netgear one.
Yeah, with the Linksys WRT54G router, there was an initial post on the bug track mailing list. And the post went on to say,
I put out this access point at a client installation, and I could get to the web management console from the external network. And it turns out that the access point was set to router-only mode instead of access point and firewall mode. And it basically disables all firewalling rules on the router, allowing the access, the default configuration in all the new routers. It's set up so that you can't access the access point from the external LAN. You can only access it from the local area network. So, I mean, that claim got pumped way up by the media and a lot of stories that are out there. I think that there was never an access point that shipped with that. You probably got a return unit.
There was one, I believe, that I read about, I think, a month ago, that Linksys actually put a firmware upgrade for. Am I right? There was one, though?
Yeah, they did release a firmware upgrade for it that made so when you were in router-only mode that you couldn't access the web page as well. But it got kind of blown up. I think that Linksys basically put out a firmware upgrade because they were getting so much snuff from the press.
And let's see here.
So it probably wasn't even a firmware. They were just like, you know, throw some code. Say it's a firmware upgrade, but really nothing's wrong.
Yeah, more or less it's a configuration issue than a firmware problem.
So I thought that, like, on mine, I actually have I have the D-Link, and you can actually get access to, like, the router from the wireless point, which is kind of interesting. But you have to have full administration, you know, like, through everything. Yeah, you really have to crack it in order to do it.
You know what I found out is that I didn't know the D-Link cards do the Prism chipset.
Some of the models.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which means they can actually be an access point.
Yeah, any Prism 2 card can be turned into an access point.
Yeah. I just found out. Okay, yeah, actually here, then let me read this one about the Netgear. Basically, and this is a write-up from BugTrack, the Netgear WG602 access point contains an undocumented administrative account. The web interface, which is reachable by both interfaces, the LAN and the WLAN, contains an undocumented administrative account which cannot be disabled. At any user logging with the username super and the password 577-7364 is in complete control of the device, this vulnerability can be exploited by any person which is able to reach the web interface of the device with a web browser. And search on Google revealed that 577-7364 is actually the phone number of ZCOM Taiwan, which develops and offers WLAN equipment for its OEM customers. Currently, it is unknown whether other vendors are shipping products based on ZCOM OEM designs. The verified affected version was firmware version 1.04.0, and the possible vulnerability not verified with other firmware versions, WG602 version 2, all other ZCOM-derived WLAN access points.
Okay, I just completely glazed over on that one, so...
Oh, that just means that... I was just giving out some... If you want to check out the version number of your, you know, Netgear product, if it had that,
oh, okay.
It's affected.
Good, good.
So... All right. Okay, here is one of the top stories of the show today. And... top story of the show today.
This just in.
This is the Big Brother story of the show today. RFID-enabled license plates to identify UK vehicles. Woohoo! Well, there's... All right, go ahead. Rusty has won the microphone. Back to VR.
It's been returned to me. We're fighting over a microphone over here. So if you hear some, like, smacks and some girly squeals, that's Rusty.
Oh, gosh. Go ahead, Ned. What were we going to say there, Rusty? Make sure you lift the talk rate into that. Just say hello.
Hello.
Okay. All right. All right. Basically, the UK-based vehicle license plate manufacturer Hills Number Plates LTD has chosen long-range RFID tags and readers from Identec Solutions to be embedded in license plates that will automatically and reliably identify vehicles in the UK. Yay! The new e-plates project uses active battery-powered RFID tags embedded in the plates to identify vehicles in real time. The result is thus the ability to reliably identify any vehicle anywhere, whether stationary or mobile, and most importantly, in all weather conditions. Previously, visually based license plate identification techniques have been hampered by factors such as heavy rain, mist, fog, and even mud or dirt on the plates. The e-plates, hey, that's a good idea. Put dirt on your plates. Don't use those deflectors.
Oh, yeah. That's really good.
Or you could always put on a Spider-Man mask and drive through a couple times just to mess with the guys taking the pictures.
Yeah.
That is pretty good.
But now they do just attack the owner of the car. I had somebody have that happen to them. They just go after the owner. And, you know, one thing, too, is actually now I'm just going off real quickly, is they have these one plates that you can see the license plate from all angles, but you can only be like 30 feet away. So it's perfectly visible. Up to, like, whatever the distance is, 30 or 50 feet or something like that. But when they have those photo radar cameras that come down an angle, they can't see it.
There's another interesting technology with the photo radar license plates that the cameras used are video cameras or digital cameras. And you have a RF beam going over your license plate that nobody can see. And if you've ever taken a picture while pushing your remote control and you notice, like, there's a white flash of light where you can't see anything, it actually covers up the license plate to the camera, even though the human eye can't see the RF.
Wow.
Well, I just saw some web cameras that actually had an LED that used it. It was for video at night that you couldn't see the light, but it was on because it's out of our visual range. And the same kind of thing.
Huh.
But the best photo radar license plate cover I've seen is one that you only get to see half the license plate. At a certain, you know, like the angle that you would be from the photo radar van or whatnot would be.
The e-plates project has been under development for the past 3 years at a cost of more than €1 million and is currently under consideration by a number of administrations. It's hoped that the e-plate will be one of the systems trailed by the UK government in its forthcoming study of microchip license plates. The plates are about the same size as conventional plates and are permanently fitted to the vehicle in the same way, but each e-plate contains an embedded tag with a unique encryption identification number that is transmitted by the tag for detection by RFID readers. Multiple tags can be read simultaneously by a single reader at speeds of up to 320 kilometers per hour or 200 miles per hour, up to 100 meters or 300 feet away. The reader network, which includes fixed location readers for use on the roadside, portable readers for use in surveillance vehicles and handheld devices, sends a unique identifier in real time to a central system where it is matched with the corresponding vehicle data, such as registration number, owner details, make, model, color, and tax insurance renewal dates. Pretty scary. A key benefit of the e-plate is that the tag providers are encrypted are encrypted in secure ID code, which is registered with the UK Ministry of Transport Vehicle Database. Well, that's such a key benefit for them. This code prevents tampering, cloning, or other forms of fraud that can currently happen with camera-based systems. Additionally, the ePlay is designed to shatter if anyone tries to remove or otherwise tamper with, and the tag can be programmed to transmit a warning if the attempt is made to dislodge the plate.
Right on. Well, that's a great little... I wish they did that with all license plates. They try to tamper with it, it just shatters.
Why?
Let's say you have a personalized plate that you really like.
Yeah.
Well, if somebody steals it, you can never get it back until they find the plate.
I think if they check the plate, they'll notice that the make and model of whatever the car they're putting it on is probably not the correct make and model.
No, I actually had a friend that had that issue, and the cops actually took the plate off the car and went, you need to call the DM, you know, talk to the DMV to get a new license plate because this one is stolen. I know what you're, you know, I even said that. I know this is your plate, but they shouldn't have done that because it's a stolen plate.
Yeah, but I think you're missing the major point here, or maybe you're just not addressing it with your statement.
No, that's a very subtle ramification which had specific import to me.
Okay.
I didn't miss the big point.
Okay. The big point is the large amount of abuse that could be had with this kind of thing and circumvention of being anonymous and your tracking of your daily habits and places you may go.
Well, now if they link that to the black box in your car, you know, that would be even worse.
Well, the black box in your car is really for accidents. It doesn't really now track where you're going unless maybe you're using OnStar, which is a whole other special box called the OnStar box that comes with your car. The system is expected to use the identification vehicles for applications such as security, access control, electronic payment, tracking and processing, electronic payment, traffic management, and customer service. Commercial applications could include car dealerships, rental companies. I don't mind that being in a rental car. Maybe I do. Insurance companies, fleet operators, and parking garages. In the public sector, the main applications would include enforcement, compliance with road tax insurance and mechanical checks, access control to restricted areas combating vehicle theft and associated crime, and traffic flow counting and modeling. According to Richard Taffender, operation director of the Hills number plates, the e-plates were developed to provide companies and public authorities with a more reliable way to positively identify and capture information on a vehicle. Now, you know what? Most things in this world are done for money. And the only thing I could really see right here is the fact that they're selling these services that they can tack on these other associations and stuff like that on there. Plus, you can pay for records. If you're an attorney and you want to figure out in the case what this guy did, and maybe he murdered someone, and you want to find out where he went. That's why those sun passes that they have for toll booths, a lot of people refuse to use those because they can actually be used to track where you went, what time you went there. So, you know, I think...
Which would really suck in a divorce case.
If you had something to hide in that particular area.
It depends what side of the divorce case.
Exactly.
You know, but the problem here is that things like that should be a choice if you want to take those kinds of risks. You know, so if you want to have a system like OnStar and you want to have a system like this to, I don't really know what benefit you get out of it unless they get all excited about, it seems like a horribly inefficient way of tracking stolen cars because you'd have to get it within 300 feet of it. So something like OnStar would be a lot better system because it transmits at a very far range compared to that. I don't really see a benefit on the consumer side, but I do see a benefit on the company sides and state side for enforcing all sorts of things and making sure that they happen. But, you know, it kind of sucks if you're held to such a high standard, making sure that every wrong you do is taken care of and everything like, you know, you miss a bill or all sorts of stuff like that. And you're getting slammed left and right for all these different things and being tracked. It really is kind of a burden to have those kinds of things put upon you because nobody's perfect. And if everyone's being able to held accountable for all things at all times according to, you know, laws that get created that you don't even get to vote on, most of the time, that's very upsetting to the citizens, I believe.
Yeah, I think there was a study done where, like, the average citizen broke a law every 30 seconds. So imagine being, like, cited for everything you've done.
Yeah.
You would be poor, destitute, and, you know, and a criminal in jail in a matter of a month, really easily, or a week.
Well, it'd be really hard to, you know, I don't know, I mean... I guess a lot of things come with a culture change. you know, if things like this are implemented in daily life, you know, culture will change to deal with it. You know, I do find it as being pretty harmful and intrusive.
Yeah, we'll just, you know, become hermits living in our little shelter and not doing anything and just plugged into whatever, you know, thing we have and, you know, just trying to get through the next day without being getting in too much trouble.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, too, is if you really want to get into sci-fi or watch, like, Japanimation, these things off in the future, right? I don't believe that, I believe that anything that you can dream of with the human mind can actually be created. You know, and a lot of these things about all these automated processes and high technology societies and stuff like that, you know, it allows people to use these technologies to gain a greater control of things that they would never have had before if these things didn't exist. So, you know, with a lot of these things that they create, let's just say there's traffic analysis. You know, what if somebody was able to modify those numbers and use that information for something malicious? You know, that's why the big concern of hackers or things like that, you know, the big concern is with them is that now they have this power to be able to do things that they would have known that society would not have been able to do 20 years ago. We were able to regulate things a little bit more with humans a lot easier than we are with machines because the power has now been elevated to another level. And things like that, I think, once integrated with society and these things with these new movies going off into the future and saying how things are going to be abused, I think is definitely going to happen. And you know, it's great. It makes for new, cool media stories, you know. Hacker modifies traffic data and you know, or hacker deletes RFID database and for cars now, you know, just all sorts of stuff. It's just going to be a new form of things going on with these new tools and
well,
systems.
At the same time, it's that our governing body has even more power and more control over our everyday lives of what we do and what we don't do, and you know how they can control us to do, you know, to be more productive members of society. Because that's really what laws should be, is just legislating what is the most optimal way to behave in society.
Yeah.
And then you get into, like, you know, is it Steven Spielberg's, like, 3811? Yeah. Then that becomes a very scary place to be.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, there is levels of laws that need to be in place, but that's, you know, one of those things is a lot of those levels of a lot of those laws have systems built into them to where they can, you know, give you lenience, or they could prosecute you very extensively, and they have that leeway because I believe that that's how things in the world exist. Just because you disobeyed a law, and what, how did you do it? What was going on? How much punishment should you get? And you know, the more we standardize things, more and more, you know. These lawmakers have to do something with their daily lives to be able to make money, right? But there's never enough laws for some reason. You know, we always need more. So, you know, they're going to be writing more and more. And it's just going to get so defined. It'll just be sickening. And it'll be really hard for anybody to fit this mold. And there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be impacted by that.
Well, because I see that, you know, I completely lost it.
All right. Did you have anything to say, Rusty?
Yeah, but I decided against it.
Okay. So there's a lot of nothing going on over there.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was. It was my one law that I'm going to run for president for now, is that there are no laws but one, that if you hurt somebody else, you broke the law. That's it.
Wow, then a lot of people are going to jail. Or whatever the punishment is for that, because that
well,
happens.
Well, you know, then make the, you know, the punishment fit the crime. And
then you begin to... all this, like, you know,
well, it's the same kind of thing that happens in courtrooms today. Yeah, there's a guideline of, you know, if you do this, then there's a proportionate punishment for it.
Yeah, but think of the burden you'll put on the judicial system, as well as more people who are going to have to define what is and what isn't, and look at the mess that the judicial system is right now.
It's like writing the Bible for, you know,
well,
the law.
Yeah, it's taking away all that and just going and putting in one heuristic in place. Because you can sue anybody or criminally or civilly for just about anything.
I think you just want to make it a little funner on your terms, VR.
Oh, yeah. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, that is what it's all about. All right. You know, we've talked about this in the past. A lot happening. But basically, a firm had bought some hardware on eBay, and it did contain a large customer database on that hard drive of the hardware. A customer database and the current access codes to the supposed secure internet or intranet of one of Europe's largest financial services group was left in a hard disk offered by sale on eBay. The disk was subsequently purchased for just €5 by mobile security outfit PointSec Mobile Technologies. According to PointSec, one of the hard disks contained highly sensitive information from one of the Europe's largest financial services groups, with pension plans, customer databases, financial information, payroll records, personnel details, login codes, administrative passwords for their secure intranet site. There were 77 Microsoft Excel documents of consumers, customers' email addresses, dates of birth, their home addresses, basically a whole lot of stuff. If exposed publicly, could cause irreparable damage to the company. PointSec isn't prepared to name the careless company. And maybe they don't have to. Maybe they should just call the company. No, you know, maybe they should, because now it's just showing that their lack of security policies to keep their customers safe.
Yeah, that they were just negligent in their in their capital handling.
Yeah. Microsoft.
Yeah. that was cool. It kind of sounded like a Decepticon for a moment when you did that. In 2000, Sir Paul McCartney's banking details were discovered on a second-hand computer discarded by merchant banks Morgan Grenfell Asset Management. The PC was released into the second user market without being wiped clean of data. PointSec purchased 100 hard disks. Sounds like they're just doing this for fun. They probably purchased that and then they offered their services to the company, which probably isn't a bad idea if they know what they're doing. Purchased 100 hard disks at their auction site as part of its research into the life cycle of the lost laptop. It has been able to read 7 out of 10 hard drives bought over the internet at its auctions, such as eBay, despite the fact that of all had supposedly been wiped clean or reformatted. The company, and format means deleting the partition table, typically, at most companies. You just wipe the partition out, and that's it. But all that does is remove the table, and it leaves all the data that's there. If you had a reader and you're able to go down byte by byte, or bit by bit, actually. The company said the exercise illustrates how easy it is for the identities of opportunists to access highly sensitive and valuable company information from lost laptops and hard drives. All the 100 hard drives and laptops purchased as part of PointSec research will be destroyed. As far as I'm concerned, what I do when I throw something out, like I keep records here, and if I throw something out, it actually just goes on the grill with a little bit of lighter fluid, and it just goes up in flames.
And some butter. It's really tasty.
And butter, yeah. And they do have hard drive disposal places that you can dispose of hard drives.
They could purchase a drive to Gausser. A lot of companies are shredding their drives now. I mean, there's a lot of solutions that they could do. And if you look at the cost of a breach of security because you throw your data out, versus, how much you're going to make off this used drive, it really doesn't make any sense that they're even selling these hard drives.
Yeah.
So why don't you pay, some kid, $2 and give him a hammer and just bust them all up?
You can still get it off the drive as long as, if you don't...
Then you burn them.
No, you can still actually, they'll survive burn too, some of them.
You can melt the platters in the smelter.
Yeah, you can do that. It depends because...
That would have been the greatest, teenage job for me of, destroying hard drives and just getting out all the angst.
Breathing the fresh hard drive destroyed air.
Oh, there's nothing that smells as sweet as burning hard drives in the morning.
Well, you could burn the hard drive, but I was thinking to be effective, you really have to have a really hot furnace, to be able to throw it in. Other than that, it's going to get nice and dark, and they're going to pop it open, and they're going to have that platter in there that's going to be perfectly fine. And I mean, they've even scavenged underwater hard drives and stuff like that. As long as the electrons are still there on that platter, they can grab it. Data doctors does that in town. There's actually data doctors all over the place that'll do that. Okay, and this is another thing. It's a big, long article here talking about some stuff that I could probably word a little bit better if I just scourge it myself. Passwords can sit on hard drives for years, basically what the article is about. But, every time you go on the Internet Explorer, and even on Mozilla, I think it's set by default to try to remember your form fields and passwords and crap like that, or even cookies that are left from websites that you've been to. All that stuff gets saved to your hard drive, and for the most part, nobody cleans out that cache. Nobody cleans out any of that stuff, and it just stays there for quite a bit of time. I've seen computers that have been up for 3-4 years, and they've got about 2 gigs of cache. My hard drive's running out, and I go look at it to clean it up, and they've got about 2 gigs of freaking internet cache, and you can see everything they've went to, which is kind of funny because sometimes you can, they look very conservative, and I don't know if it's their children or what, but they're going to some interesting places.
Yeah, they'll blame it on their kids.
Yeah. But, you know, those kinds of things will stay there for quite a bit of time unless you take them off, and a lot of that information is just stored like crazy. You know, even it's browser, period, you know, from doing that. And, you know, browsers even on Linux do that. There's a cache area for Mozilla or any of those, you know, Unix, Linux, open source based browsers. So all that information is there as well. So, you know, everyone's affected by it. And as well as passwords being in files and files you don't delete and you know, stuff like that. So managing that information and where it goes is important. Otherwise, you know, it could be grabbed. All right. Well, this is just a little bit of information here, which is kind of interesting. Broadband internet use has been up 42% in 2003. So people are jumping on board to broadband. You know, and I actually, when my ISP Quest here screwed some things up, partly our fault, partly largely their fault, they had I had to use dial-up for a while. And I'm upset because a lot of my common sites that I went to, that a lot of people go to, dial-up was extremely slow at loading it. Slashdot loaded really nice. There's a few sites that do colors and tables and frames really nice to where it makes the site look really good and it's able to load quickly because the color and stuff like that. It's not a graphic. It's just a piece of line, a string that says use this color. But there's a lot of sites that use a lot of pictures and it really took a long time for those things to load. So, all right, this is something new. Well, they've been doing it for a little bit. The EFF, they basically have an initiative to protect innovation and free expression. Now, I believe that this comes from software patents from the UK. I believe it comes across from the DMCA and all sorts of things that are going on, plus some of these insane patents that they have out there that are really, you know, like Microsoft patenting, you know, double-clicking and stuff like that. For years, or every year, numerous illegitimate patent applications make their way through the United States patent examination process without adequate review. The problem is particularly acute in the software and internet fields where the history of prior inventions, often called prior art, is widely distributed and poorly documented. As a result, we have seen patents asserting on such simple technologies as on our one-click online shopping carts, the hyperlink, video streaming, internationalizing domain names, pop-up windows, targeted banner ads, paying with a credit card online, frame browsing, affiliate linking. The harm these patents can cause is the public is profound. Unlike most technologies, software and the internet have attracted a vast number of small businesses, nonprofit, and individual users, each of whom has adopted and built upon these resources as part of their daily interaction with computers and the online world. From open source programming to online journaling to political campaigning, the average citizen is using new technology online and their desktop as often as any traditional company. With this increased visibility, however, comes increased vulnerability. Previously, patent holders had only targeted competing companies. These companies have established legal departments and outside counsel and are thus able to defend against illegitimate patent threats. Now, some patent holders have begun to set their sights on a new class of technology users, small organizations and individuals who can afford to retain lawyers, who cannot afford to retain lawyers. Faced with million-dollar legal demands, they have no choice but to capitulate and pay legal fees that often fund more threat letters and lawsuits. So the basic thing here is that, you know, with some of these patents saying that, well, I have this idea and you don't, you know, a lot of things on the internet and technology period are processes that work well in many situations. Some people can take that process, use it in a different situation or in a different way than somebody else, and it still works just as good. But if you patent the basic process and say, well, you have that basic process, it's like patenting the basic building blocks on life, and now that nothing else can propagate because of it, because you say you have a patent, which is very harmful to you know, creation and everything like that. And that's, I'm totally behind the EFF on that, and I'm actually behind the EFF on most of the things that they do.
I want to patent the word
Yeah. So that is a word I use. That's probably bad English. That's what I was told. I was told in English class. But hey,
I would be a multi-billionaire.
Are you sure about that?
Pay up, baby.
We're gonna have to sue him for that. No, you know, it's just that is something that is Very large, the things that's going on. Actually, I've got an article here.
He said very large.
He said very large. Here, you know what? I'm going to read this patent. Actually, it was one of the last stories. U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has granted a patent to the Microsoft Corp. for a time-based hardware button for application launch. A time-based hardware button for application launch. That's what a click is right there. Which a click of a button can start different programs if it is clicked once, twice, or held down for several seconds. The patent number 6,727,830 was granted on April 27th. However, mouse-wielding computer users need not worry, as shortly the patent only applies to handheld computers that run Microsoft's Pocket PC software, especially the method of bringing up different features depending on how many times a button is pressed. The abstract of the patent says a method that a system or method and system are provided for extending the functionality of application buttons on a limited resource computing device. Alternative application functions are launched based on the length of time an application button is pressed. You know, whoever wrote that line must write, like, you know, textbooks, you know, where they're able to, like, take an idea and span it out over many pages, because that is a very large but accurate description. Well, the first one that I read for clicking, that's insane.
Yeah, and I really hate that sort of thing, especially, like, I can really see that I would really get ticked off with that, especially with Microsoft, because, like, if it doesn't do what I want it to do, I end up clicking it several times and, like pounding on it. So I could see that I would start bringing up and making it do quite a few different applications, which I didn't want it to do because it wasn't doing the initial one in the first place.
Well, it's just, I think a lot of people, when they start clicking, then they start moving the mouse and they're just clicking everyone, and the computer starts caching what you're doing, and it'll go back and slowly click it as it's able to run that code that it's supposed to run.
Then I end up getting a really big hammer.
Yeah, and then smashing hard drives. Yeah, actually, we have a lot of stuff here. We're going to move pretty quickly.
I thought the last story was going to be the last story.
No.
Oh, okay.
No,
I thought you said that. That's
no,
just question
not,
there.
Not at all. The BBN Tech unveils world's first quantum cryptographer network. Something you're hearing more and more about, and that's why I bring it up on the show, because it's becoming more of a reality. Actually, it is a reality. It's becoming more popular. The BBN Technologies announced that it has built the world's first quantum cryptography network and is now operating continuously beneath the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts, today, which is back in early June. DARPA Quantum Network lists BBN's campus to Harvard, links BBN's campus to Harvard University. Soon it will stretch across the town to include Boston University. As a third link, the Harvard University application, Applied Physics Department and Boston University Photonics Center have worked in close collaboration with the BBN to build the network under Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, sponsorship. Get the kids to build it. And then put it out there in the
That's
field.
That's right. Yeah, the whole world is built on the backs of master's students.
Pretty much. Because then after that, you start wanting money, and then you don't want to do any creation anymore.
Yeah. Then, well, then once you start working on your PhD, then you can get other master's students to do your work for you. It's great.
And then they monitor which countries you go to with your PhD.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is another thing. Yeah, you know what? There's just so many things to talk about. It's almost enough to warrant a weekly show, but I don't know if my schedule could handle a weekly show. Basically, the BT, which is, I think, the British telephone network, the BT Transference Phone Network, BT is planning to rebuild its phone network in the UK in a radical move that will cost billions. It could change the way people use their phones and allow most people with a BT phone line to plug into broadband using computers, mobile phones, or mobiles, and other devices. It could also mean that mobiles and fixed lines becoming interchangeable with the same number and bill. BT plans to convert the majority of its customers to a new network by 2009. Basically, they're just going to move over to voice over IP and make it so you can plug in anywhere. Probably have a smart card type chip on the means of communication, be your little phone or whatever, and you would say, bring me my access over my Wi-Fi, or, you know, go ahead and do it through, I mean, it's probably going to be wireless regardless. So your Wi-Fi at your home, your Wi-Fi somewhere else, over a cellular network, everything, and it'll just go back through voice over IP.
But that brings up some really interesting security issues.
Well, as the cell phones, when they first came out, as we've talked about cell phone scanning and listening on their ranges of all sorts of different things, 900 and 1800 ranges, 800 ranges, megahertz. I'm going to skip by these things as fast as I can. Did you have something to say? I'm sorry. I just keep going. You just went ahead and jumped
right
in.
No, you're fine. You're fine. I just thought, I hope to God they don't use Wi-Fi for any of these applications because the protocol is slot as hell. And I mean, anybody who uses anything Wi-Fi for anything mission-dependent is just dumb.
Yeah. Well, as well as when we did talk about, and you may have deployed this in a place that you know about. We talked about once back where there's a medical institution that wanted to do Wi-Fi repeaters all over the place, and then you'd be able to take these phones and go from place to place, and it would transfer from one Wi-Fi access point to the next, and you'd be able to have complete communications for doctors all over the hospital. Something that we had.
Well, that'd be nice. Is it? You know, do you know of any more reliable, more secure, like Wi-Fi protocol?
No, I mean, as far as 802.11b, g, a, they all have the same flaw. Whereas the management frames are not authenticated, so you can do a DDoS flood attack on a network and disable the network, and it doesn't matter what type of encryption, what type of authentication protocol you're using, because there's no authentication of those management frames.
Yeah.
So it's actually just the program that's involved with it.
He's saying that any other access point could jump in and take over the connection. The management frame is the frame that management's like, it's broadcasting is like, this is me, the access point. And anybody can say, this is me, the access point. So whatever one, it can choose to go to another one is the problem.
Yeah, so you send out frames saying, I'm the access point, you have to de-authenticate. It's not authenticated in any way, and everyone's dropping.
So if the beacon frames actually said, here's a piece of code that says I am the this piece of code, this string says I am actually the access point, and on the client side it says the access point that broadcasts with this piece of string says that it's the access point is the access point, then they don't have that.
And it may not even be the access point. Or it won't be the access
point. Or it could
point.
Be somebody that decrypted that ID and put it in the client. Or, you know, I mean, just, you know, well, clients don't broadcast what their ID is. It would be they'd be authenticating from the beacon access from the number it would pass across the air, but you know you could say somebody stole that number and put it out there, or some you know employee gave it out or something like that. So it's a bunch of crap, you know. It's a lot harder to get to a stack of wires in a room. You have to break physical security, people's eyes, stuff like that. Which you know that can be done as well. This is, let's see. Basically, this is talking about why realistic graphics make humans look creepy. And they do. Like, if you look at some of these new games, you know, and they're, like, there's this, was it Final Fight or Final Bout or something like that, this new boxing game for Xbox, and I think it's on PlayStation 2. I mean, they look so cool. But it looks so weird to see them moving around, stuff like that. They look like, it looks like if you watch, like, a zombie, you know what I mean? Because you're like, that's a dead human being, you know, that's like, that doesn't look human. It looks creepy. And that's what it says here, is that they noticed that more human-like... in 1978, the Japanese roboticist Mashiro Mori noticed something interesting. The more human-like robots became, the more people were attracted to them, but only up to a point. If an android became too realistic and lifelike, suddenly people were repelled and disgusted because we're altering what we know as trusted shapes, trusted visuals, and now... If something else can be like that, it breaks our whole trust structure that we've had for thousands of years.
It's going to make Doom 3 a really cool game is what it's going to do.
Yeah, Doom 3 is amazing as far as that goes.
Well, that brought to, you know, I was thinking about, well, that brought to memory, thinking about, was it artificial intelligence, you know, with the robot kid, and they're, you know, he paired up with the gigolo robot.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's you know, kind of a freaky thing there. Prostitute robots.
Kind of like a real doll come to life.
Yeah, are you watching some weird robotic porn?
No, that was AI.
No, that was AI
a couple years ago.
Oh, okay.
Mainstream film, no, you know, back locked away little cupboard in the movie rental store.
I see. Okay. Now I'll just leave that alone. Star Office is moving over to Ontario Ministry of Education, covering 2.5 million students. It's moving over to Star Office, so...
Yay.
We just like to put the word out there that alternatives are coming in place and spreading that out. And also, along with Sun has backed up an announcement that Solaris Server Operating System will have an open source flavor by making a similar promise for its Java technology. And then basically speaking exclusively to Builder AU, Sun's Java technology evangelist Raghavan Srinivas said, well, basically this guy is saying that Java open source will happen, but declined to elaborate on times or specifics on licensing arrangements. We have worked on how to open source Java, but at some point it will happen. It might be today, it might be tomorrow, it might be 2 years down the road. So no major hope there. But I guess it's going to happen. Maybe when nobody ever uses it anymore, I don't know. But it'll happen.
Yeah, when it's a completely archaic system, then they'll be like, oh yeah, here you go. Have fun with it. Make it valuable again.
And, let's see, NASA will be doing a robotic servicing mission to the Hubble. So they didn't give up on that.
That's good. I was really kind of disappointed when the initiative came out that it was going to just burn up.
Yeah. Basically, they announced the agency's decision to pursue the feasibility of a robotic servicing mission on the space to the Hubble Space Telescope. NASA initiated the first step towards enabling such a mission with the release of requests for proposals today. The due date of the proposals are July 16, 2004. This is the first step in a long process of developing the best options to save the Hubble. So,
yeah, is there the address there to find out what their main priorities are, and if like anybody can submit a proposal?
Oh wow, you want to?
Oh yeah, I'm all about that.
Oh gosh,
I'm looking for a job.
Looking for a job.
if anybody has any like think tank openings, you know, and I'm, you know, just email, you know, submit a message to
You know, the forums aren't up right now, actually, because I'm still working on getting that database connected.
Okay,
you know,
well,
you can
whenever.
Just send an email to slipmode@yahoo.com, but check out the website slipmode.org and look at the email and how I spell it. It's slpmode at yahoo.com. So that's the new email address. I updated that on the site. And the forums will be up shortly as I'm working with the ISP or the hosting service to get that going. That's really bad to do because if we need those drawers open, that'll rip that wire out. But basically... yeah, so they're considering that, and that doesn't really mean they're going to do it or not. That just means a consideration. They could just say that we're not going to let just go. What they're going to do is blame it on the considerations. Well, you know, but they may get something up there. And this is kind of neat to wrap things up because Rusty has something that's very interesting and to talk about. I was thinking about it. I was like, hey, I could mention this, but I'm like, forget it because Rusty was the one to discover it, and he would be the best person to discuss it. Finishing up here, basically there's going to be a private spacecraft to launch June 21st. The world's first privately built spacecraft is scheduled to leave Earth on June 21st. If successful, it'll usher a new era of space flight for private enterprise. You know, the great thing about this article is you can see that the pop-over ad prints over my news story, which is very great. But,
oh, that's really cool. I'm already itching for a vacation.
Yeah. So... VR is the last person I want to have to comment on when I say such things like that because it's cool. No, it sucks because it's in my story. But basically, it's going to go to an altitude of about 50,000 feet. The craft will then separate from the jet and glide for several seconds before its rocket's engines are ignited. The 80-second burn will propel the craft to Mach 3, three times the speed of sound, and into space. It will cruise for 3 minutes beyond Earth's atmosphere, approximately 100 kilometers, 62 miles above the ground. The pilot will then perform a maneuver called feathering that reconfigures its wings to increase drag and bring it back to Earth. The vehicle will touch down on the same runway it left about an hour and a half earlier. It's a nice little hour and a half drive.
Yeah, it probably went completely around the world.
Well, no, it's gonna go for three minutes. Do you think it's gonna go?
No, it's gonna glide for three. What is it?
It's gonna go up above our atmosphere for 3 minutes and then come down.
Well, then he's going to circle around, but it would be much cooler if he just kind of went around. Depends on how fast he was able to go.
You just want him to go around.
Yeah, that's right.
It's all about what VR wants.
Exactly.
So
if I had the time, the money, and the resources, I would have made that years ago, man.
Me too.
That's right.
No, I probably wouldn't have. Because that takes a team of very intelligent people.
Out of common household items.
Yeah. Oh, don't even bring it up.
Hey, you know
this would be like the fourth time you've done it on
no,
the show.
No, it's been once.
No. Okay, go ahead. Just
no, I'm just like, you know, and I have. Well, I've already explained my whole mission to Mars that I just didn't get done. Made out of household materials.
Yeah, okay. Basically, you know, if it's so easy, you should have done it by now.
I got responsibilities, baby.
Oh, okay, all right. Okay, well, basically, there was a, we brought this up in previously in the past, about the Microsoft versus the UE, actually the UE versus Microsoft, over being monopolistic with their media player and other things, and basically lost, I think it was a $492 million loss to the EU, and now they're going through their, they're basically filing appeal, and that's what this article says. The appeal to the European Court of First Instance will take at least 3 days of that money. In the meantime, the court may turn down Microsoft's upcoming request to suspend the remedies until the period, until after the appeal, forcing the company to change the way it does business in Europe almost immediately. Basically, just over 2 months after that, that the company has said it intends to file its appeal, it did. And we look forward to filing our appeal and believe we have a very strong case to present to the court. Well, anybody can make a really strong case, especially with software nowadays, it seems like, because it's a very complex issue. All right, well, we've gotten through all that and gotten tongue-tied a few times, but I'm going to give it away to Rusty to describe something that he came across and use his expertise to dissect, and here it is.
Well, it's nothing new, but it's alarming that this type of thing would even be allowed to exist, or to be stumble across something like this anyways. I'm on an IRC network connected in the channel talking to some friends, and someone posts a link. It's a link to a picture. I'm using a fully patched system, Microsoft Windows XP, my mistake, big mistake, running latest virus scan, all the latest patches, and I go to this webpage, and there's a photo that loads. I don't think anything of it. About 30 minutes later, people start messaging me, hey, or that was a funny picture. So I'm like, I didn't message you. You know, what's going on here? Turns out, I do a little bit of research, and I look at my system, and I notice that inside of the IRC client, there's some modifications that make the client automatically go out and message people with this URL, this link I just clicked on. Immediately, I look at the process list. I notice a process that shouldn't be there. I kill the process, and then I go look in the registry. I notice some new registry keys. Turns out there's a Internet Explorer vulnerability that allows a JavaScript file to execute an application on the computer system.
You don't say.
I don't say. Oh, again, it's not patched. Patch Tuesday was last Tuesday, and they missed it.
Huh.
And through some more research, I find out that this process is connecting to another IRC server. It's a rogue IRC server on somebody else's compromised system. I connect to the IRC server that my PC is connecting to without my knowledge, and there's about 800 clients connected. And there are two operators in the channel issuing commands to control this army, this zombie army. And as Slipmode says before, you know, 80% of all the spam comes from compromised PCs. People wonder why this stuff is allowed to exist. And, I mean, it comes down to a flawed operating system is used to insert this code that, I mean, allows PCs to be hijacked by anybody. It wasn't complicated. There wasn't a lot to this Trojan, but, I mean, you know, some kids now own 800 PCs.
Was it 800 or you said 8,000?
I believe it was 800 the first time I connected, and when I connected the second time, there were quite a few more. Bit more. I don't remember the exact number.
Do you want to discuss anything else that followed after that?
Well, I was able to shut it down, you know, contact the ISP of the IRC server that was the hub where everything's being controlled from. They submitted the pattern files, but nothing's been done by either Microsoft or by the antivirus vendors yet. It takes an awful long time to get a virus pattern through any of these antivirus vendors unless you've got a direct link to call them up. It's kind of disturbing as well. Think how long something could propagate or spread.
Now, did you... You said that you'd spot another, like, Security Focus article that was similar?
Yeah, there's actually an article on Security Focus. I don't have the URL handy right now, but if you do a search on Security Focus for IRC Trojan, you can read a little bit more about this type of exploit or this type of method being used to control PCs. By turning a PC into a IRC client, you effectively bypass any corporate firewall. So you've got a client behind a firewall. Typically, it protects you. Now someone issues the commands to this bot that's sitting in this channel, and they can look inside the network. They can update code on the PC. So they've got full control, bypassing any access control,
any type of firewall, anything you've got in place.
You know, I was wondering, too, because we read an article in the past, and I talked to Krusty about it, but something they call SatBot, which is a bot that basically allows itself to do all these functions. Update, propagation, various means of exploitation, numerous means of restarting itself once removed, you know, and they call it FatBot. It's supposed to be some sort of underground thing that's out there, and just the idea of it is an idea. It's they can have things that are like that, and they've labeled it FatBot, but there could be various programs that operate on this level. And I think, you know, Rusty had stumbled across one of them. And, yeah, they could modify it to do whatever they want. Oh, I want to run spam through this. Sure. You know, I want to send hundreds of smiley faces to their screens. I'll just upload the code that allows me to do that. Do that, you know. It just makes your computer do as it wishes.
Yeah, I want to harvest their browser cache with all their credit card numbers that they haven't cleaned for the last 2 years, and I want to take all of them, and, I mean, I want to make some money.
Not me.
Yeah, that would be VR.
Do you have anything to... I thought you wanted to say something there, VR?
No, nothing to say there.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, it's pretty disturbing. But, hey, you know what? I think me and Rusty are going to do this. Rusty is the Wi-Fi man, and I try to be as such, but I'm still learning. And what we're going to try to do, because Rusty got a great deal on some parabolic antennas, and I think we talked about it, we're probably going to do something maybe for Hack TV or something like that. And that was, what we want to do is we just want to play around with these new antennas that we got. And these new antennas can shoot a distance of, an estimated distance of 90 miles.
If you have line of sight and you've got 200 milliwatt radios on each side and you've got, I mean, perfect alignment with a 200 milliwatt radio, according to calculators on various websites, you can access, you could do 90 miles, but that's, I mean, that's going to be very difficult because of
yeah,
the
we're not going to do 90 miles, but
I mean, yeah, technically, yes.
Yeah, and 90 miles, would I say to sustain like 1 megabit, or was that the least transmission?
Yeah, that would be at 1 meg.
1 meg. Okay, so we have these things, and we just feel like playing with them, and it might be fun to kind of document it, and so that's what we're going to do, and once we have enough time to do that, which will hopefully be in the near future, hopefully within a month, we'll go out and do this, and we'll comment back on it in the future. But we're just we have two laptops. That's what you need. Two Sineo cards. That's a 200 milliwatt, actually 249 milliwatt if you modify the transmit power, which is basically a quarter of a watt. Which I found out by FCC guidelines is the maximum that you could use to transmit with a 24 dB gain antenna. And we have two. Well, Rusty has quite a few, but what you need is two. What we're using is two 24 dB parabolic grid antennas, and which is a directional, and we'll point them towards each other. We're going to find out where we're going to do it. You know, I don't think it'd be a distance of more than 10 miles or something like that, but we're going to find out where we can do it and shoot it and kind of document it for fun and talk about it in the future. So.
Maybe kill a few pigeons while we're at it.
Yeah, and if we can, we'll attach like a battery to it and see if we can microwave people because it operates on the same frequency. Actually, well, that thing covers 2.1 to 2.7 gigahertz. Is it the whole range of that?
Yeah, the actual antenna is designed for that range.
That whole range. So, but yeah, it's pretty neat, and we're going to try it out and see what we can do. What we're going to do, and I think...
So let me get this straight. You can communicate to each other over, like, you know, 90 miles... And cook yourselves lunch at the same time?
No.
Not with that low of power.
No.
Oh, okay.
If we got like a 10-watt amp or something and stuck it right at our head, we might start getting dizzy, you know? You could probably kill insects, you know, repel rats, whatever you want to do.
Give yourself premature Alzheimer's.
It also makes for great birth control, and we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, if you like. You know, another thing, too, that... Well, I think what we're going to try to do is one's going to be an access point, one's going to be a client, and then what we're going to try to do is just send data back and forth, whatever. Maybe we'll come up with some corny thing like, you know, I was on a Graham Bell, you know, say like his famous lines of his first communication or whatever, just some sort of geeky thing to make it fun.
Yeah, I remember at the wireless shootout at DEF CON last year, they used the same type of antenna, 24 dB antenna, to connect like 12 miles to an omnidirectional antenna that was only 12 dB. So. I mean, you think you've got an antenna 24 dB point-to-point, it should be relatively easy to get a much further link.
Yeah. So, you know, who knows how far me and Rusty will go, but maybe...
all the way, baby.
Yeah, you know, I found out we can actually do it through Camelback Mountain, through all the way down to South Mountain. There is a flight path there, but I was reading, and who knows, this was actually, I think, was it Seattle Wireless, or was another guy's whole understanding of some of the FCC laws, and he put it down, and he was talking about interference and stuff like that with various things. He said that it is a possible of interference with, you know, the telephones operating at 2.4 gigahertz rate. There's a possible interference for, you know, other Wi-Fi networks, you know, but there isn't anything that would bug any sort of, like, airplane equipment, satellite equipment, radar equipment, anything like that. With the amount of power that we're using, it wouldn't affect anything like that. What would be is that equipment could possibly affect our equipment's quality of going back and forth. So that was about it. So it's something to test out, and maybe, you know, we'll try to see how ridiculously far we can get and see if we can pull it off. All right, well, that, I guess, wraps up the show, unless anybody else has anything else they'd like to add to the show. No?
No, I'm done.
You're done?
Yeah, I'm done.
And we're done. All right. Okay, well, that's going to be it for the June 13th edition of the In and Out Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, signing off.
This is VR saying, remember to clean out the belly button lint.
And this is Rusty saying, you're disgusting, but that's all right. I still love you.
All right. And we'll see everyone in 2 weeks. See you then.